Studio 360.
So, glass menagerie, glass buildings. When it comes to buildings, it wasn't that long ago that glass had this very particular role. It formed windows, this rectangle set into the wall to let some light in. But a big part of what makes the modern world modern are perfectly rectangular buildings that are all about glass. They're glass skins. And that's due, in large measure, to a small art and design school that existed very briefly in a small German city in the early 20th century, the Bauhaus. The Bauhaus was founded in Weimar in 1919, 100 years ago, which is why I'm talking about it today.
My idea was always we have to do something together to destroy these separations between painting and sculpture and architecture and design and so on. It is all one.
That's Walter Gropius, who was a founder of the Bauhaus. Its stars included the artists Kandinsky, Moholy Nagy, Albers, and the architects Walter Gropius and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, both of whom ran the school as well. Even though the Bauhaus only lasted for 14 years, the architecture and design faculty became so influential that the school's name became the name of a movement and is still practically synonymous with modernism. So to get a centennial fix on the Bauhaus legacy, especially in America, I called my friend Francis Bronette to go on a field trip to look at some of New York's Bauhausian buildings.
Andiamo.
Or however you say that in German, I guess.
Francis is an architect and president of Pratt Institute, the architecture and design and art college in New York, where I happen to serve on the board.
Even the question of what is Bauhausy, right? What does that mean?
For the original Bauhaus architects, it meant more than just aesthetics. After the hell of World War I, they wanted to make the world a better place.
When we look at the origins of Bauhaus, it had a social project. This was an industrial revolution. It was a moment in time where you were building new professional class that was going to be using new materials, new techniques, new processes, new tools, and develop a whole new world with that, where more people could have access to it. More people could have better lives. That was the intent.
The lasting big Bauhaus idea in architecture was that modern buildings shouldn't look like decorated cakes, but like the sleek engineered machines they are, showing off their modern construction techniques and modern materials like steel and plate glass and grids of columns and beams and cantilevers with flat roofs.
So what was the Bauhaus about? It was deep experiments with new materials, new technologies, new ways of thinking about labor, because they were trying to figure out the place between craft and manufacturing. They're walking into the Industrial Revolution. They're coming out of the First Industrial Revolution. What can we do now to generate things for everybody? But also, what does technology reveal about the making of something?
Right.
What can we do?
After the Nazis shut down the Bauhaus in 1933, the architects, Gropius and Mies, as he was called, emigrated to America. And Mies set up the important U.S. Bauhaus outpost at the Illinois Institute of Technology. He even designed the campus, where, until just a couple of years ago, Francis was provost.
I not only taught at IIT and lived on a Miesian campus, I actually lived in a Mies tower on Lakeshore Drive.
Really? Along the lake in Chicago.
Yeah. So Mies van der Rohe, his father was a stonemason, so he grew up learning about craft, very, very deep awareness of how you make things, attention to detail.
Of course, about those buildings, not everybody in America instantly loved Mises to pieces.
Mies, isn't your purely technical approach to architecture a denial of aesthetics, of beauty?
No, I don't think so at all. I think the technological approach is just to use the means we have in our time. And the aesthetic is a question of proportions, of detail. Somebody said, God is in the details.
But before long, he and his influential followers helped bring the Bauhaus DNA to every new post-war American big city, including here in New York.
375 Park Avenue. Not just another New York office building, but in the words of architectural leaders, a singular landmark with aloof and aristocratic qualities not likely to be often repeated in any city anywhere. a new standard of architectural quality.
Here we are at the Seagram Building, one of the great buildings, certainly of Park Avenue, of New York, of America. It's still, to me, a beautiful building, but it's probably not as extraordinary as it was when it was put up 60 years ago.
Well, of course, one of its extraordinary features is that it's still extraordinary, right? That it's timeless.
Yeah. It's this dark black steel and glass.
Basically. It's actually coated in bronze.
Uh-huh. Really?
And this one has a kind of patina that wasn't the norm.
In the search for a special dignity and design, age-old bronze was chosen. Other New York skyscrapers wear faces of aluminum, steel, glass. But this building, sheathed in bronze, is unique.
The Seagram Building is 38 stories, just tall enough to be imposing. Amber-tinted glass, dark bronze, and out front, this perfectly scaled stone plaza with two decorative pools. The building is as refined and serious as a bespoke business suit.
This is also a building in some way that, you know, expresses its structure. Okay, so you see the basically what other people would call columns, but they're not columns.
Uh-huh.
The vertical elements that are
uh-huh.
going all the way to the top
uh-huh.
as singular strips all the way up. Unrelenting, right? They're not broken.
Uh-huh.
Do you see them going
up? Yeah.
So those are actually added onto the structure. They're not doing anything other than an aesthetic.
Construction men speak of them as mullions. These columns have two architectural tasks to perform. They separate the floor-to-ceiling windows, and also they multiply the vertical lines rising majestically from the glass-walled ground floor to the top of the building. Here is accent, unrestricted, pure upward movement.
So when people say, well, Mies didn't use any decoration, it's ridiculous.
Right.
You have to look at all of these details. You know, look at where any kind of grate is placed. Everything is absolutely deliberate.
Right.
There is nothing arbitrary about where things land and where the joints look like. It has a certain kind of proportion and
right.
rhythm,
right.
right? And symmetry.
Right.
That's, in some ways, a kind of controlled discipline.
Yeah.
And what's interesting here is that it has this incredible fluidity from inside to outside.
Right.
It's pretty remarkable.
Right. You can see that fluidity between inside and outside that Francis is talking about when you look at the pink granite that paves the building's lobby, which is the same pink granite on the surface of the plaza just outside the lobby's glass walls.
And the surface is continuous. It goes right inside.
Oh, right.
There isn't a threshold.
And it's the same material, just goes right
same
through.
Same material goes right through. So
uh-huh.
he's basically saying as though anybody could come into the building. Everybody is welcome. There isn't this monumental staircase and you have to sort of ask, do I belong here? It's, you feel like you can come on here, but there are some discussions about this because he says everybody can come here, but there's no place to sit.
Then we headed inside the building.
Here we are in the lobby of the Seagram Building, which is grand, but not bombastic or gigantic. And it's kind of small.
Modest.
Modest.
No, it's modest.
It's what? Two stories, maybe 100 feet by 50 feet, glass and bronze and beautiful travertine marble, right?
Yes. And it's fascinating to me to see what's here because I'm sure these desks, this is not a Miesian aesthetic. They have too much detail. They're not as elegant as the building itself.
Uh-huh.
The level of precision that,
right.
and control
right.
that he wanted. Now, in fact, there's a lot of work and writing about modern architects wanting to control what you were wearing, the furniture.
Yeah.
In the lobby of many of their residential towers, Mies van der Rohe, for example, would have designed the chairs.
Oh, Frank Lloyd Wright was doing that before there was
way
these
before.
Guys. Yeah.
Slippers, everything was
yeah.
taken care of. That is actually the critique often of the work. Does it allow for people to truly inhabit the space?
You mean as opposed to being too austere and hard?
Well, you have to be controlled. And so I think that the real question is, what are the parameters by which we can occupy these spaces
yeah.
and feel okay about being in them?
Right. So let's walk across this gorgeous continuous floor/plaza over to the Lever House.
Conveniently, 50 yards away was another masterpiece of the Bauhaus aesthetic. A building I just love.
Lever House, 390 Park Avenue.
It was built in 1952 as headquarters for the Lever Brothers Soap Company.
From Lever House in New York City comes the greatest skincare discovery of our time. Dove creams your skin while you wash.
It was designed by Gordon Bunshaft and Natalie DeBlois, who were American disciples of Mies and worked in the Bauhaus mode.
So there were architects already bringing this, what ultimately became the international style.
Right. They were explicitly influenced by all these European modernists, including the Bauhaus guys, right?
Absolutely, because this work was already being done everywhere.
In Europe.
In the 20s and 30s. Now, was it being built that early?
So it existed on paper, buildings like this.
Well, Mies van der Rohe was doing drawings of glass towers that were very, very sophisticated in the 20s and 30s.
So it is this very slender glass slab and this mirrored blue-green window glass, which is a very distinct part of the building, right?
Well, remember the context in which they're operating. The streets was a set of buildings that were brick and stone.
Right.
And all of a sudden, there's this very, very light, almost diaphanous project that challenges the sort of heaviness
right.
of these other impenetrable buildings.
Right.
And this building is thinking about opening up space so you could actually see it.
Right.
And I think what's really important about this particular building is its play with openings and solids. And light and void were very, very central to the way the Bauhaus experimented and looked at projects. So you have an open space on the ground that anybody can go into. So you're on the street, and then you're in this beautiful covered space, and then you're in this courtyard that's completely open to the sky. So I think that's what's extraordinary. Again, the play of inside, outside, this building is actually, I think if you go back to its social agenda, if you want, it's giving back to the street.
Right.
It's saying to the people, yeah, you can come in here because we don't have anything marking the edge of it.
Right.
The sidewalk goes right into the plaza. People are cutting right diagonally across it. They feel that they're welcome to just enter fundamentally private property.
The Lever House architects worked for Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, which was the modern American firm when I first heard of architects as a kid. Among other things, Skidmore designed the former Sears Tower in Chicago, the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, and skyscrapers and banks and corporate buildings almost everywhere. Frank Lloyd Wright referred to Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill as the three blind mice.
Many people will say Skidmore, Owings, Merrill were the firm that understood Mies and that work, and we're able to develop it into a very, very corporate model. Very sophisticated, and became the firm to do the most eminent corporations.
Right. Which is another way the Bauhaus had this, was immortal, or at least had this life in the United States and the rest of the world beyond the actual dudes from the Bauhaus.
Right. But it was also about, can the building itself be part of the brand? So the Lever House was part of the brand. You know, think about it. It was transparent. They're selling soap.
The building is the headquarters of a soap manufacturer who has a natural interest in keeping things clean.
It becomes an advertisement for Unilever, right?
So you're saying Seagram is just a big bottle of scotch, basically, in that sense, I guess.
Oh, there's the bronze.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there you go. But one of the other things to be aware of is that there seems to be a small irony, right, in the fact that the Bauhaus started off as a social proposition, and then the first buildings to emerge are corporate entities,
yeah.
Right?
So these modern buildings in the mid-50s in America seem like the very expression of sophisticated and modern and new, which America was so trying to own and be at that time.
The difficulty, of course, is that in some ways, to do this as well required an incredible discipline.
Right.
And not everybody had it. And it was also easy to copy. So by being easy to copy, some of the very sophisticated nuances get lost. And then, of course, how do you do this without doing 1,000 iterations, losing money on the job? So I think that people started to shortcut that, not understanding the values of the proportions of how people move through the building, the relationship of the scale itself, how big can you go before, in fact, there is failure, aesthetic failure. So if you look across the street at whatever building that is,
whatever,
across the street.
Who cares, 1990, whatever.
Right. Yeah. There's a kind of value engineering there, right?
We're not going to. That's the phrase, right? The value engineering is the architecture phrase for making it cheap.
For taking out things that might cost too much.
Yeah.
Right. And so much smaller panes of glass.
Right.
So much less expensive, much less difficult to install.
Right.
And again, we're trying to figure out ways to make things faster, better, cheaper.
Right.
And sometimes the design was one of the things that got forfeited.
Yep.
Right? Remember, some of the most extraordinary designs have a poetry to them. And that when you go in, they're not just about, oh, I get it, blah, blah. You actually feel something. You feel something about being in a space which has been so well articulated that it actually moves you. And there are a few of those spaces. And sometimes you have to be there for a while before it becomes a part of how you experience it. It's not going to happen in a moment.
Beautifully said, and that is true of these two buildings, each of which I have hung around a couple of dozen times in my life, and I feel that with both of them. Frances, Madam President, thank you.
Thank you.
Frances Bronett is an architect and the president of Pratt Institute. You can see pictures from our field trip and the buildings we visited at studio360.org. By the way, if you're going to be around Chicago or in Germany during the next couple of months, there are a few Bauhaus Centennial exhibits that will still be up in early 2020. You can find out the details at studio360.org.